This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on May 28th, 2013. We are talking once again to the delightful John Sheehan. This marks your fifth appearance on the show, correct, John?
That is correct.
And tonight we are talking to you about RunScope. So we lobbed the question out on Twitter, and the one question that we got asked was, what is RunScope and why should I care? Which I think is kind of a nice way to get started. So what is RunScope and why should we care? And if you're not convincing, we might just, you know, kind of cut it.
Okay. Yeah. That was such an eloquent tweet, too. Very well stated. right to the point. So RunScope is the ultimate API integrator developer's toolbox. So what we're trying to do is make it easier for you to debug the problems that you encounter while working with APIs from a consumption standpoint. So there are a lot of tools out there for helping you produce APIs, but what we're really concerned with are the app developers who are actually doing the integrations, taking APIs, whether those are third-party services, you know, social public APIs or private APIs, internal APIs, taking those, integrating them into their apps and helping them right now, specifically around debugging and testing, and long term with some other things that we can talk about later. But the biggest concept that we have is taking sort of this invisible API traffic and making it visible. And once it's visible, letting you do all sorts of things with it. So to start out with, like I said, debugging. So if I'm having a problem, just let me see, you know, the request that my client is generating that I'm sending to the API so I can figure out what's going wrong there. You know, we have some sharing in there, so you can actually take a request you've made and share it with somebody else so they can take a look at it and tell you what you're doing wrong or right or whatever. And then we also have the ability to sort of retry requests from the website. So if you make a request from your code and then it's not quite right, you can, on the website in the request editor, you can edit it and retry, so you can tweak it until you get it just right, and then, all right, that's the parameter name that I need to include, then I'll go back to my code and update that. And then doing some testing things. So if you star a bunch of requests on the web, you can actually then retry all of them and verify that the responses are still what your client is expecting. You can do response playback, where you take a previous response that's in the system and then play it back without hitting the end API again. So this is really good for integration tests. So let's say I make a call to SendGrid, which normally would send an email, but in my test, I don't want to send an email every time I run that test. But what I really want to do is verify that my code can handle the different responses I would get back from SendGrid. And so you can generate those once and then play back those responses on demand. So it's a series of tools like that. We've got some other interesting things for like webhook debugging and opening up your local machine to the public internet, but we can talk about that more in detail. Ultimately, our goal is make consuming APIs, relying on APIs, as easy as it is to rely on any other code that runs in your system. We have a sort of a company thesis that, you know, when you rely on an API, you're not just taking on a service dependency. That's actually code that you just happen to not write that is running on someone else's service. And you should treat it like it's code that is under your control. And so the same amount of testing rigor and the same amount of debugging facility should be available to you.
Okay. So you're now, like, you've launched, so people can go to runscope.com and just get started, right?
Yep.
Okay.
So we started on this late last year. We started on actually building the product out. And then last week we did sort of our full public launch. So we had a preview running over the last couple of months where we were, you know, letting a few people in. Kevin Dente, you may have heard of him. He was actually our first user outside of me and my co-founder Frank. So he was one of the very, very first people that put up with a lot of problems and bad user interfaces and gave a lot of great feedback and sort of how it should work and what needed to be better. And then last week I at GlueCon, it's just a big sort of API conference in Colorado, I gave a keynote on the first morning talking about sort of the nature of modern applications now and sort of that distributed code thing that I was just mentioning, and how this is the new default for applications and that we're really advancing further in our use of APIs than we are in the tools that support that use. And so that was when we announced the opening of RunScope and got a couple press articles on TechCrunch and NextWeb, and it was a good day.
Awesome. Okay, so I'm thinking it makes sense to first start by going into some of those features in more detail. So on your website, you've got listed traffic inspector, request editor, shared request, and passageway. And I know you've kind of highlighted, you know, like you've talked about those at a high level, but can we dig into, first of all, what is traffic inspector?
Sure. So we've kind of grouped all of the stuff that lets you see actual API calls under the umbrella of Traffic Inspector. And the way this works is that in your code, instead of calling an API directly, like let's say you were using Stripe, for instance, you would go to api.stripe.com if you were going to make that request directly. What you do instead is you create what we call a RunScope URL. And what this does is takes that original host name and sort of encodes it into a new host name that also associates it with a bucket, which is what we call the unit for where you store requests. So every request gets stored in a bucket. Every bucket has a key. So to make a RunScope URL, what you do is you take the dots in the original host name and you replace those with dashes, and then you add a dash bucket key dot runscope.net. So what you're doing is, in essence, is taking that request and pointing it to us through that new host name. So everything terminates through us, and then we end up extracting the original host name out of that subdomain and then making the request from there and then returning the response back for you. So it's a little bit of a misdirection, kind of a fancy URL trick to get the original domain there. But the nice thing about this is that means that we don't need to know anything about the APIs that you're hitting before we hit them. So if it's publicly available and we can get to it from our servers, then we can allow you to essentially, you know, funnel that traffic through us, and then you can start seeing it. So this is really great because a lot of other tools that have sort of attempted to give you some visibility kind of require you to change parts of your code in other ways. So one common thing would be that they require you to change like the way you authenticate your requests, or require additional parameters or that, anything like that. So what we really wanted to do was remove the amount of configuration needed to capture the traffic. And so we got it down to the absolute bare minimum that we could. So outside of the host name, you don't need to change anything else. All of your original headers, all of your original form parameters, URL parameters, all of that data stays completely intact. And so what you could do is you can actually flip it on to start debugging a problem. And once you've solved it, just change the host name back, and now you're hitting the API directly again. And again, the rest of your code remains unchanged. So this idea, we call it our traffic gateway, that essentially is the technology that captures traffic and then shows it in the Traffic Inspector. Once you're in the website, you have a way to view like sort of a stream of all the traffic that you're putting through it. We have some sort of convenience methods around like a view that shows you just errors, right? So if just show me the 500s or the ones that didn't connect for whatever reason. You can star requests to easily find later. That's really great for like starring a bunch of them and, like I said, retrying them all at once, so you can compare the original responses versus the responses you're getting now to sort of verify that an endpoint is still going to give you something expected. And then, like I mentioned earlier, the sharing, being able, we'll get to shared requests. But the Traffic Inspector is just a stream of all of the API calls that are flowing through the system for your buckets.
So essentially, you set up RunScope to just be a reverse proxy.
Yeah, so the technical term, it is definitely a reverse proxy. We try to avoid the word proxy for a lot of reasons. One, you know, proxies have a specific technical limitation, but this is in essence a reverse proxy where you make the calls to us, we capture them, but remake them and then capture the request and response while sending it back.
So do you add your headers onto the request so you can, you know, filter it out, or as it's coming back, or, you know, if there's certain things you want to check? I guess I'm asking technical implementation details.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't need to get into that yet.
So we don't transform the request other than on the response. We do add a RunScope message ID header on the response, mostly so that we can let you know where to look for it. And it's more just a convenience for us than anything else. But other than that, right now, we don't transform or modify the responses in any way. We do have some ideas around that. So one of the things people ask us for a lot is that they're using an API that uses some kind of complicated signing mechanism or authentication mechanism, and they want to sort of simplify that for their development type stuff. Being able to basically cache credentials on our side and then apply them to all the requests that go through a bucket with some basically a more simple, you know, authentication method against us originally. So we might explore some things around that. We don't have any specific plans there yet, but once we start sitting in the middle of the traffic, there's actually a lot of really interesting things we can do that makes it, well, much easier on the developer side, and can actually improve performance in some areas and improve security in others.
Well, that was my next question. So, because as you're describing what you've set up, I mean, it basically is a man in the middle, like beneficial man in the middle thing, right? So how, you know, what kind of security concerns are there? Is it, you know, how do you handle things like authentication and security and stuff like that?
Yep. And how is your data store secured? So what happens if someone compromises your website, and now they have access to hundreds of replayable traffic requests that may or may not be hitting against, you know, public production APIs.
Yep. So we're very, very, very concerned with security, and you know, man in the middle obviously has sort of a negative connotation to it, but we are a blessed man in the middle, for lack of a better term. But if you go to runscope.com/doc/security, you can read all about our practices and how we handle everything. I don't want to like get into all the boring nitty gritty detail of that, but we take it very seriously. We have an extremely talented lead ops engineer that we hired who was previously at Pinterest. So he's got an extensive background in building robust, secure systems. And it's a very high priority for us. In the future, we want to do even more around that, and basically look at ways where we can offer encrypted storage of your data over time. Again, we don't have any specific plans there, but those are the types of things we want to do. Right now, if you do make the request to us over HTTPS, we do relay it over HTTPS. We basically, you know, relay over whatever protocol you send it in on, so that if there is something you want over SSL, that it's over SSL the entire length of the discussion between us and the API. And then some of the other features, we have like this passageway, which we'll talk about later. The original version of that we sort of started from the open source project did not actually encrypt that traffic back and forth between the client and the server. And we added encryption there to make sure that we had end-to-end SSL and things. So if you're interested in that, I definitely would encourage you to go to runscope.com/doc/security.
Interesting. So you actually create basically a second SSL panel between Runscope and the end API, and then you take the decrypted response and then plug it into the pipeline going back the other SSL channel. Well, okay. Anyway.
Yep.
Interesting.
So one other thing, and I guess, you know, everything just funnels through, so it all works out. But I was just wondering about things like two or three legged auth, or, you know, things where you've got kind of a lot of moving parts. I guess it all just kind of, you make your request and then it's as if Runscope was the client as far as any other servers are concerned, right?
Right. I mean, as far as your client is concerned, it doesn't see anything other than Runscope. But the proxy, for lack of a better term, is dumb. It doesn't really, like I said, it doesn't change anything about the request. So there is actually one other case I just thought of. If you make a request that has a response that comes back with a location header, we actually will update that location header to be a Runscope URL, so that if your client follows it, that it will still be captured. But again, very minimal changes, and only really changes that are sort of expected by clients and expected by our customers. So we want to be as transparent and sort of dumb in that layer as possible.
So I've actually got two questions. So the first question is, I've got an actual real world scenario, and I wanted to kind of step through it. It's fairly simple, really complicated about it, but it's something that we had to do recently. And I was wondering how Runscope would fit into that. That might be a little bit longer. It'd probably be pretty short, actually. The second thing I was going to ask about was geolocation. So we're sending the request off to you, and you are located somewhere in the cloud, the world of clouds, and then you send it off to the API. How does that work with like geolocation apps?
So all the requests that we make currently originate out of Amazon Web Services US East 1. That's sort of just a matter of convenience for now. In the future, we want to give you control over where those requests get made from. So if you're in Azure in Asian data center and your app is there and the API you're calling is there, there's no reason for you to have to cross, or for you to be crossing an ocean and make that request. So someday down the line, we want to make it so that you get a lot more control over where the hops are in making those calls. So that's that answer. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I was wondering about that because, you know, it's going to look like, hey, well, we're always getting served the East Coast times for, you know, my soap opera schedule on my TV mobile app instead of where we are.
Right. Yep.
Not much you can do about that until you scale out and get big. So the first question, second, I guess, was, so we're incorporating a web service API. It's a soap on a rope API through a third party network. And the way that we connect to both their staging and production servers, the API, is via a assigned cert that they issue to us. We set up Runscope to allow us to debug and with assigned cert.
Right now, we don't support custom certs. That is definitely something, again, that's another one of these, something we're going to have to do in the future, because just not every API is open and uses HTTP basic auth or OAuth or whatever. So there's a lot of, you know, unique, you know, authentication scenarios like that that we have to cover. So one thing I should mention is that the gateway that we use now, where you create the RunScope URL, is sort of like our first way that we want to collect data. Over time, we are not really interested in everyone using that for every use case. So there's a lot of use cases where, like, the biggest one would be all of the traffic is happening on my private internal network and is never even available over the public network. Like, how do we capture and view that traffic? So we want to make sure that we offer a wide variety of ways of capturing traffic, you know, that meet basically on-prem, cloud, you know, distributed geographically, you know, custom cert, that sort of thing. So we have some ideas for how we're going to approach that. And that I think that'll be something that we hopefully can take care of in the medium to short term.
So since you're just kind of translating these dashes into dots in that gateway URL, I assume you support non-standard port numbers in there as well, right?
Yeah, so we do support non-standard ports. You actually do have to specify that as a header when you make the request. So you always make the request to us over 80 or 443, but then if you include the RunScope request port header with a different value, when we make the call, we'll actually make it on that other port and then send it back to you over the connection you made.
Okay, so let's keep moving through the features here. We've just talked about Traffic Inspector, which sounds like it's kind of like the main, I don't know, it seems kind of like the main use, and it seems like it fits, you know, the mission of what you're doing the most. Well, I guess...
Well, the replay stuff and the shared responses, I think, will come into play in QA and debugging, because, you know, it's always the case that the QA guy says, oh, I did it, and it didn't return the right response, and then you try times in a row, and it always worked.
Okay, good point. So let's talk about request editor. As I go through and I look at my dashboard, I can see a bunch of requests that I've made, and then I can just go in and click on the pencil and start typing away, right? Just edit it.
Yep. So one thing I really wanted when we started talking about this was sort of like these fundamental ideas of being able to edit an HTTP request as if it were any other, I guess, like, output from any other code or app that you wrote, right? So like if you write a console app, you get output from that, and then you can copy and paste that and, you know, into whatever else. But if you needed different output, you could just copy it and then tweak it and then paste it into whatever you were going to do. So sort of like making them more tangible was, I guess, making requests and responses more tangible was a really big point. And so what we really quickly found is that we really needed a way from the website to take any given request and be able to transform it and change it and sort of mold it into something new and different, and then execute it again right from the web without having to go back to your code. We actually also allow you to create just new ones from scratch from the web. But the editor is very similar. It's kind of inspired by a website called hurl.it, which is originally started by Leah Culver and Chris Wanstroth back at a Rails Rumble in like 2009. When I was at Twilio, I acquired that site from them. I have since tried to reacquire that site, and I have not yet had any luck. But
I love that site. I just have to interject, but I use that all the time. Like, you know, you get all these short URLs, like via Twitter or just people, there's short URLs all the time. And that's kind of one of my favorite quick ways of just saying, like, where does this actually go? And you can follow redirects and you can say, oh, this redirects three times to, you know, some .ru site that, you know, I mean, like, you can quickly see if something's good or bad.
Oh, God, this is going to send me to Bing.
Right. So, I mean, it really is. So our internal name for it is Burl. So it's browser curl, basically. And like hurl was the same thing. It was HTTP, you know, curl. And it's very much heavily inspired by that. We've gone and like taken sort of the idea of hurl it and really made it fully functional and also just a lot more robust. It handles a lot more edge cases than hurl it does. You get more permanent request storage, not permanent request storage, more long-term request storage. You get history, the ability to edit existing requests. Today I added the ability, I don't think this is deployed yet, but the ability to sort of automatically fill in fields in the editor from the URL. So you could basically send somebody a URL with a template built into that URL. And when they get it, the editor will be pre-filled with those values. So we've really taken the idea of hurl it and made it really what it should be. And so hopefully from now on, instead of you going to Hurlit, you can go to the request editor and just try it from there.
Good point.
We also built in some nice handlers for basic auth, OAuth 1, digest authentication. There's a integration with an OAuth 2 tool access token generator that you can, you know, generate tokens right from there. So the editor is sort of like, it's more code than I think anything else in the dashboard, but it was really important that we had a really robust editing experience around HTTP requests.
So most of the time when I'm using a request editor or something like that, it's usually when I'm involved in hardening a website or testing it to see, oh, you know, how can we, are there any SQL injection points? Are there any other, you know, cross-site scripting points where we can get in? And there's several commercial ones that I've used before, but I was wondering if you, as a side project, if you guys had thought about integrating some of the OWASP tests into it as kind of a feature. So you could say, okay, so here's the API you're hitting. Here's how secure your data is going to be hitting it, or if, you know, even coming back, like if it's an internal API or something, you say, okay, we're going to eventually expose this to the outside world. Let's run it through some security tests and say, okay, try looking for SQL injection, looking for redirect attacks, looking for cross-site, you know, stuff, injecting that into the headers and form fields and stuff.
Yeah, I guess what I'd really like to be able to offer is something where people can sort of create their own collections or a group of templates of requests and then share those with other people and then let them all execute them. So, you know, a kind of community around, you know, collections requests, like API providers might provide a collection of requests that you can generate a set of error responses for just to get those in your account. But I'd love to see that people use it for that. And hopefully I can give them the tools to sort of curate their own collections if OWASP wants to put one together, or if, you know, a good security guy wants to put together a common one that he can share with other people. That would be great.
So, and that leads us to the next feature on the list. Right now you've got support for shared requests. So you can go through, you can look at your current requests. And actually the first time I saw this was I forget if I had a problem or if I was trying to figure out how to do something, but when I was doing the beta, then you said, hey, you know, share the request with me, and you were able to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, it's really nice for support. So back when I was doing Twilio support, this would be the biggest thing that, like, I would have killed to have, because, you know, we'd have customers who were, you know, putting the username and password in the wrong place, or were not, you know, including the right parameter names, or maybe the wrong parameter name casings, like simple things like that. Like, once you see it, it's so easy to solve, but without being able to see it, it's really difficult. So what we did is we added a simple sharing mechanism. It basically works like Dropbox's the way you share a file. So you take any given request, you create a share link for it. As long as you leave that link public, it's, you know, sufficiently random so it can't be guessed, but whoever you give it to can then inspect that request and then get back to you to let you know why it's not working. So it's super simple, but it's really useful. Like, we use it all the time internally just to, like, debug internal problems, but even with our customers that email in with problems, it's just it's so much easier to say, hey, can you share that request with me and just let me see it, than it is to, like, ask them for their code or, like, ask them to describe how they're trying to make the request.
Is there a way, like, I'm looking at a URL now. It's like, as you're saying, it's very long. It's not guessable. But is there a way that I can imagine for something, maybe it's, you know, very secure or whatever, and I would want to, you know, more privately share it. Is there a way to, like, download a request, or, you know, like, I know there's some formats for, like, request response, like Fiddler supports some. And, you know, is there any kind of way to do that now, or thoughts about adding that in the future?
There's no way to do that now. That's something we've talked about doing in the future. One of the other things you can do is we have team accounts. So if there's, like, if it's you and a bunch of coworkers that want to share requests, you don't have to create the public URL. You can just send them, you know, the private URL, and then you can share it amongst your team. And then it just sort of never leaves your borders. For publicly sharing requests with more sensitive data, there's a couple things we could do there. So one of the things we've been discussing is maybe allowing for people to actually, like, redact parts of it. So, like, I want to send it to you, but I don't want to include my username and password in the auth header, because that's easy. Decodable because it's only base 64, so maybe I'll just, you know, basically redact the auth header value when it's shared, but you know, keep it for when I'm viewing it. So those are definitely scenarios that we want to solve. Right now, if anything's too private, then we probably want people using a team plan for that.
Okay, so, and then the last big feature that you call out is in beta still, right? And that's Passageway.
Yeah, so Passageway is based off of a project called Local Tunnel, which was created by Jeff Lindsay, who is a former Twilio colleague of mine. And what Local Tunnel and Passageway allow you to do is you install an agent on your machine, and then what you tell it is, all right, I want to open up a tunnel or a passageway onto my machine on this specific port. And that goes out to our server and says, all right, I'm going to listen on this port. Send me everything that you get back to this port. And so your machine has this private connection to our servers. And then what we do is we create a public URL that is just on regular port 80 and SSL. And when you go out to that URL over the public internet, we basically, you know, send it down the passageway back to your machine and then send whatever your machine returns back up to the public internet. So this is great for a lot of things. So the most common thing that people were using Local Tunnel for was just the ability to show off sort of like the local dev version of a website you were working on. So I've got some changes and I want to send them to a client. So I'll create a Local Tunnel. And now I got a public URL where the client can view it. And it's great. Passageway works great for that too. And if anybody wants to use it for that, I'm happy to have you use it. Some of the more like API specific things that's really good for, one of the big ones is webhook. So if you've got a local webhook receiver on your machine and no public URL for it, that's actually really difficult to test with an API provider who needs it to be a public URL for them to hit. So what you can do is you can temporarily open up your machine with Passageway, you get a public URL, you put that into the webhook provider's interface, you generate some test webhooks or some real webhooks, and not only are they sent to your machine so you can actually test your code against them, we log them like any other request, so you can actually see the data that was coming in from the webhook provider that was then relayed down to your machine. So for webhook debugging, it's invaluable. I almost can't live without it now because we do a lot of webhook stuff and there's just no other way to see that traffic. And then the other thing that's really good for is if you have a mobile app and you want to test it against an API, and again, if you have the local dev version, maybe you have some changes you want to test, temporarily point the mobile app at your passageway URL. Now it's funneling requests to your local API. You can test to make sure it works with the changes, disconnect the passageway, change the mobile app back to the production API, ship your changes essentially. So those are probably the two biggest API related use cases for it.
So I could see that being useful in on a continuous integration server where you have user tests or unit tests, integration tests that are running against this API. Say, okay, create a passageway to this server, my test server, run the tests, make sure the tests pass, make sure the requests look okay, and then disable the passageway to that server.
Yep. And so one of our really early customers is actually already integrated into their CI process, basically doing exactly what you just described.
Basically, I mean, you just set up port forwarding on the server, right? And so you're back to wherever. So it's almost like you're just network terms, you're a gateway, and you're port forwarding from the web API back to one of the internal IPs.
Yep, but it's actually the protocol between RunScope agent, which is the passageway client, and the server is I'm blanking now. It was originally a reverse SSH tunnel. The original local tunnel used reverse SSH. And so you'd have a secure tunnel back and forth. The new version that we're actually using, I'm forgetting off the top of my head right now what the protocol is. I think it's something Jeff Lindsay invented, but essentially it's a socket connection between the agent and our server. And in our case, we've encrypted it, but the conversation just is a long held relationship between the agent and our server. But on the other side, it's just a regular, you know, HTTP listener that just translates that and sends it down to the wire in your machine.
So to install, that's the only thing that's not web-based, right? Everything else is, you know, you just go to your web server. In order to install Passageway, you install Python, and then you do pip install runscope, which is basically like pip, I'm just guessing. Pimp, that was awesome. So pip is just like an installer.
Yeah, pip would be like the equivalent of npm or NuGet.
Okay, or homebrew or chocolatey or whatever, right?
So it's actually, it's Python's, you know, package manager, right? So more like npm or, like I said, like NuGet. But you can actually do some more like packagey-like things like it that are more like homebrew or apt-get, I guess.
Is pip the one that uses eggs, or is that easy install?
I
think it's easy install.
Easy install uses eggs. Pip actually sends down a tarball.
Yeah.
Okay.
So during the preview, this configuration mode delivery via the Python package manager is sort of just during the preview. Eventually, we'd like to make that available via homebrew, via downloadable EXE on Windows, you know, a regular OS 10 installer, all of those things. Right now, we're trying to, you know, sort of suss out some of the other issues. Issues is a bad word, but other edge cases with it while we work on, you know, a better install experience for the agent. So long term, the agent will do more than just passageway two. There's actually another, there's right now it ships with another command, which is a curl command. So if you do on the command line, you can do run scope space curl space and then any regular curl command. And but what it does is automatically creates the run scope URLs and then tracks them in that bucket. So you don't have to do the translation in your curl commands on the command line, because it can get a little tedious typing, like translating the domains over and over again.
Okay, and as I'm looking at that passageways, I think the first place on the site where I actually see anything about upgrading or paid accounts, which is, I think, kind of cool, like as opposed to like, boom, welcome to our site, now you need to, you know, make a choice, like you make it very easy to just kind of start using. So assuming that's correct, that I'm reading that correctly, what other things do I need to, you know, what would I pay for, and kind of what's the overall kind of business model of, you know, how do you guys get rich?
How do we get rich? That's a great question. If I knew the answer to that, I would be done already. So the passageway, there's two things right now that we charge for. One is access to passageway. So that's on one of the, we have two plans available above the free plan, the starter and the team plan. The second thing that we charge for is the ability to share it with teammates. So if you have a team of more than one and you want to privately share requests and see data across a team, then you would need to upgrade to get that. And then the other one would be volume. So based on the number of requests that you put through, the starter and team plan basically allow you a higher limit on what the amount of requests you can put through on a month. So there's basically, I said two, there's actually three sort of, you know, reasons to upgrade right now. And all of them are really signals that you are really intently using the product and that you've sort of outgrown, you know, just maybe a one-off, solving a one-off problem here, or maybe even doing some, you know, ongoing development into like API tools are like central to what our team is working on. And these are the ways that is indicated by volume or team size or the need for something like passageway.
Okay, so it seems a little odd to name the paid plan starter. Is that because this is the first of a few plans and you may have, or is it just starter and team and I'm confused why?
There's only so many ways you can say team. That was what we ran into, right?
Okay.
Like, you know, we kind of wanted to call it maybe startup, but that's a little like, you know, Bay Area. Like, yeah, not everyone's a startup. That's a small team, right? So it's kind of like we couldn't really come up with a good name for it. So
okay.
Naming plans is actually really hard. It's as hard as like drawing the lines on where the plan boundaries should be. Pricing and planning, it's one of the, you know, like the hardest things that we actually like, not to implement, but just to decide where those lines are. It's one of the harder decisions that you'll make pre-launch because you just don't know like what people are willing to pay for or how much they're going to put through it. I mean, we got some really good data in the beta that we eventually, you know, based our decisions off to, but you just don't know on a grand scale if those data points are going to hold up. So we're starting small with just the two plans. We definitely plan to add, you know, more flexibility on the plans on the high end and on the low end. Right now, if anybody wants something bigger than the team plan, you are more than welcome to get a hold of me and we will work something out. But we're sort of like planting our flag in the ground and then seeing what kind of reaction we get to it or what kind of demands we get before we you know, overspecify and have 10 plans.
You need a lucrative, ubiquitous enterprise plan, which is priced just enough that managers won't think about shaving that much off their budget each month, but still keep you in Bentleys and Benjamins.
That sounds great. I'd love to have the USS Enterprise on board.
I think $4,099 a month. Wait, maybe started at $12,999.
I'll take your credit card number right now,
and we'll get a PO every month.
Okay, so we've obviously firmly and completely crossed the line from talking about APIs over into business models and businesses and stuff. So tell us about what that's like. I mean, you've been a developer evangelist, all kinds of, you know, techie things. And so then you kind of moved over into, I mean, you founded a company. And so tell me what that was like, both, you know, founding a startup, you know, including the funding stuff, and then also launching a product.
Sure. You know, I started my first company when I was like 14 or 15 selling fake error messages that I made in VB3 that required the VB3 runtime to be installed before you could even install my fake error messages. I started another company when I was 18 and another one when I was 21. And then that's three. And then this one will be, I think that's all of them. Anyway, I've kind of lost track. So I've always been like a starter. Now, none of them were like had the aspiration level of what we're sort of shooting for now with RunScope. But like I've always started my own thing, and actually just writing software happened to be a consequence of solving problems more to support, you know, the businesses rather than like starting a business just because I wanted to write software. I'm almost like a software engineer by accident, just because it happened to be the tool that I found that actually helps me solve my problems. So I've had a history of starting businesses over time. The itch never really went away. So like, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago when I had shut down my most recent one, which I had spent the last 5 years working on part time. I originally had started working on full time, but switched to part time because, you know, I need to eat. And went back to working full time. But when I moved out here to San Francisco in 2010 to work at Twilio, really my plan was to sort of build, you know, continue building up my network, get as much startup experience as possible, hopefully have a good outcome with Twilio, and then be able to go on and sort of do my own thing from there. So it was always kind of part of the plan to start something after moving out here. So after Twilio, I went to Ift. I loved it at Ift. And what happened was, is I was sitting there every day doing these API integrations and just like frustrated beyond all belief that there was just no tools to solve these problems, and that I just couldn't believe that people were doing the same thing that I was doing every day. And the level of tolerance for pain was just that they had was so high. And so I'd get super frustrated with dealing with OAuth issues and dealing with all of the issues. I mean, you basically go down that tool list that we just described, and it's me trying to solve all of those problems that I was running into every day. So I very much loved it at Ift. I loved that product, but eventually I just got so fed up with not having tools for these problems that I realized that there was really nobody better positioned to take care of solving them than me and my co-founder Frank. So Frank at the time was at Twilio, and he was sort of ready to move on from that. And I went back to him and I was like, Frank, I think I really want to build some API developer tools. And he's like, I'm in. He did, like, that was it. He's like, I'm in, because he's a tool maker too, and he has a lot of experience. He was lead API engineer at Twilio, and he worked on Amazon and developer tools there as well. So like, that's his thing too. And so we were just ready to go try and solve this problem. And so I basically told Lyndon at Ift, I was like, I just got to go do this. This is nothing against Ift. I just got to do it. So at the time, I had really only had a really, really rough prototype for basically the host name based traffic gateway, where I was capturing traffic and then sort of showing it on a web page. So that was really the nugget of the idea, was taking just this stream, opening your eyes to it, and then like putting the data on a screen. But we didn't really have much more of an idea than that, other than like sort of what we imagined you could do once you had the traffic. So, I mean, debugging, testing, monitoring, mitigating problems, doing business intelligence over that data, like all of those things were sort of like these rough ideas that we had. And so what I did is, thankfully, due to, you know, having worked at Twilio and having been out in the community as an evangelist for so long, I had a really great network, and I pretty much called in every favor that I possibly could to start talking with investors. And so actually the first person I talked to was Nat Friedman from Xamarin, who was great because, one, he owns a developer tools company, and two, he's raised money twice before, and three, he's just a great CEO. And I had worked with him for a month in between my jobs, and got together with him, and I was like, hey, I really want to do this. You know, I'd love your feedback on it. And he's like, I'm in. I'll invest in this. And so that was really like sort of the tipping point for when things started to go, you know, really well on the fundraising side. So we had a couple other early commitments, and then the holidays hit, and then the first Thanksgiving hit, then Christmas hit, and investors tend not to work over holidays for long periods of time. So we kept hitting sort of like these stalls in the process, and it's a very drawn out process. So I probably ended up having somewhere between 60 and 70 meetings total with investors to raise the funding. And again, without my network, I don't know how we would have gotten a lot of those meetings, but we're in basically the best place in the world to start an API startup in San Francisco. So it went relatively easy compared to some other ones. So the best thing that happened, though, was actually Christmas came around, and, you know, we had been talking with investors for a while, and it was taking forever. And suddenly they go completely off the grid. Like, there's just all the meetings, all the emails, everything stops. But what that did is actually allowed us like a couple weeks of uninterrupted coding time. And so what we did is we had took that sort of prototype and turned it into what, you know, people would call maybe an MVP. I think the date I let Kevin in today, I saw, was like January 8th. So like, that was like after like Christmas to January 8th was all spent on MVP. And so we had something real then. And that was when we started to get really good feedback from Kevin and the other testers. And investors were very, once they came back from vacation, were very excited to see how much progress we had made. And by about the end of January, we had landed our lead investor, True Ventures. They had you know, committed to come on board. And once you have a lead, the rest of it is pretty easy. So we had the rest of the round committed within a few days after that. And then you go through an extensive legal diligence phase, which nobody tells you about, but is very comprehensive. And once you clear that and you get really sick of talking with lawyers and signing tons of copies of paperwork, then the money arrives. And then I think the first thing I thought was like, all right, now what? Right? Because it almost seemed, it was kind of surreal. Like we had been thinking about it for months and like, you know, trying to get it together and had talked to so many investors and had so much feedback and, you know, doubters and criticism and, you know, false starts and all of this stuff. And then just once it happened, like, it's just such a relief because, like, I knew that we had this, you know, we have a pretty good runway now to work on this problem for a long time. But what very quickly after that, it really actually just feels like you're at another starting line. So I joked on Twitter the other day that startups are like racing to a series of starting lines. And so, you know, getting the funding was like, felt briefly like finish line, but it's like, all right, the next phase, which is, all right, now we got to go find an office. Now we got to go hire people. We got to, you know, start executing on the plan that we pitched to investors. Now we have to launch, right? Like there's all of these things that go into it. So between February and now we got some office space in San Francisco. We hired an ops engineer, a designer, and another product engineer. And so they came on over the last 6 to 8 weeks. And then started thinking about when we wanted to launch. GlueCon happened to be at a good time. We figured we could get, you know, a fairly good chunk of what we wanted to get done by launch. And so that was the plan. So we called up GlueCon and said, hey, we want to launch on your stage. And again, a great connection I had through Twilio. And I don't know, that probably wouldn't have happened without that. So they're like, yeah, we'd love to have you. So we set up the launch. And spent the weeks before it sort of crunching on getting the code done, getting the content done, writing the documentation, making sure the investors were all on board with what the messaging was going to be, talking to press. I mean, there's just a lot that goes into it. It's a lot more than I think people realize that goes into, you know, coordinating a launch like that. So we had a keynote, a product launch, and a funding announcement all at the same time. And they were all supposed to hit at 10 a.m. on May 22nd. And for the most part, they did. So it was a good day. I mean, we had a lot of fun with the launch and we got basically almost exactly what we wanted out of it. So yeah, that was, it was a really good culmination of a lot of months of hard work on the product and just getting all the pieces in place. But now I feel like we're at like another starting line, right? Like, all right, now we're public. Now what do we do next? And so it's really the beginning of the next phase of, you know, getting it out there and sort of iterating on what we have and making sure that we're solving people's problems and, you know, getting out to the community and telling people about it and that sort of thing. So this is now the hard part, I think, though.
I remember when you launched, because my buddy Adron Hall was out at GlueCon too, I think, and he linked to something else, and they were saying, "Ah, oh, this is how you launch a product," you know, John Sheehan on RunScope, and I was like, "Hey, I know a guy named John Sheehan. I wonder if it's the same. Hey, it's the same guy. I thought he was at Twilio. Oh no." And so yeah, it did seem to be a well received launch.
Well, and what I remember him saying was that what he really liked about the launch was that you spent the majority of the time describing the problem that you were solving, and then you launched, you know, the solution to that problem rather than, you know, talking about, I don't know, whatever other people talk about.
Well, that's what Jobs did a lot with the iPhone and the iPad announcements too. He would talk about how, here's what cell phones are like now, and it's just so horrible and there's nothing intuitive. And then he brings it up and says, all right, this is our answer to it.
I'm going to put it in my bio now, wherever I go, that Scott Kuhn compared me to Steve Jobs.
All right, then.
Good luck with that.
Okay.
That's actually a really good point. So that was actually really important to us that we didn't talk about it in great detail until we had something to show for it. So during the preview, we tried to keep it very quiet because, you know, we were still building up systems to handle more users. But once we started talking about it in earnest, we wanted it to be something that you could go try that moment. So I'm glad that somebody noticed that, and because that was, you know, really important to us.
Okay, so we talked about, you know, you've hit another starting line. So what's next? Can you tell us anything about, you know, things you're working on or possible ideas or things that you've heard or feedback that people are requesting?
Once we started, you know, really thinking about what we want to do with this, there's kind of a phased approach to the problems we want to solve. So I think the first thing that we're doing at launch is really focusing on dev time stuff. So this is something that you're just doing while developing. It's not something that you necessarily run in production for any extended period of time for a variety of reasons, but the tools are all geared around sort of lower volume troubleshooting type tasks. I think the next phase is really sort of expanding into more maybe production use cases or more like ongoing things, so that making sure that our infrastructure is able to handle higher volume use cases, whether that's higher volume because a larger team is using it, or because you've decided to put it into something on a more ongoing basis to see that traffic in the same way. So we have a lot of work to do on the tools to support higher volume use cases. So that's sort of some of the things that we're going to be focusing on over the next couple of months, is looking for particular customers that are putting a lot of traffic through it and making sure that we build tools that suit their needs. Really long term, what we want to do is not only let you sort of debug, test, monitor your traffic, but actually let you mitigate problems. So this is something that is really not really well defined right now, but once you're sitting where we are in the chain, you can actually do really interesting things around handling problems, or even proactively responding to problems in one app that were discovered in another app. So it's something that you can't do with just traditional code because it all runs in one place. But once you start watching conversations your app is having across an entire enterprise or organization, or across a large user base, your app can actually start reacting based on API traffic seen in other clients. So we've got some long-term ideas around what we want to do there, but that's sort of like our ultimate end mission there is dealing with some of those types of things.
Okay. Let me see. One other thing we mentioned earlier is that Passageway is built on Python. As I understand it, pretty much everything at Runscope is running on Python. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's pretty much Python through and through. So the website is all Python and Flask. The gateway is Python and Flask as well. I think the only thing that's not Python based would be like Elasticsearch, which we use for some of our backend, is Java. But again, that's like, it's not code we're writing or managing. And then other than that, I'm pretty sure it's all Python through and through. I never touch anything but Python on the parts that I work on. So we have a couple different persistent stores, but even everything that calls those is all Python based.
Just kind of qualitatively or high level, like how do you compare? I mean, you did a lot of .NET development before. How do you compare Python development?
So it's funny because when I was doing .NET for the longest time, I used to scoff at the idea of significant white space. And now I'm like completely, totally 100% on board with it. It just makes everything so much more readable and consistent. Like Python has very, like across the community has very, well-defined coding standards. I mean, they have this PEP8, which is basically like the way you write Python, which is really great. When you approach new Python, it's all written the same way as the code. So you never have, semicolon problems or discussions. You never have brace placement discussions or problems. You never have like variable, naming positions or parameters or like any of that stuff. Like there's the Pythonic way, the one way to write Python, and that pretty much is mostly universally applied. So that I have actually come to appreciate a lot, because it just takes a lot of the sort of nitpicking out of the code.
Have you also noticed that there are fewer ways to do the same thing in Python? So there's pretty much, hey, if you want to do like this in the language itself, there are like 50 ways to approach it, like there are in JavaScript or in C#. There's, hey, Python has a way to do that. Here's how you do it.
Yeah, for sure. That's for the most part true. Some of the things around like the difference between Python 2.7 and Python 3.3 kind of have been changing that, and now there are two ways to do things, like string formatting, for example. There's like three ways at least you can do string formatting and interpolation, and there really should probably only be maybe one or two, but part of that is sort of in the migration from the old 2 style way to the 3 style way. So I haven't touched Python 3 at all, so I mostly stay out of that. Nice thing about Python 2 is that they're still improving it, that the package ecosystem is really, really mature and robust. There's a lot more like small single purpose packages that I felt like in .NET where like it was much more geared around having a lot of big or like fewer big packages, like less packages, but they're more big. What am I trying to say here?
Yeah, no. I see a lot of focus on trying to move away from that. I'm partly with NuGet, but then even at first with NuGet, it was like, great, we have NuGet. Here's my entire giant framework delivered via NuGet. And I'm seeing more of the move towards that, hopefully inspired by it. It's great to be able to just assemble really small things without needing to like make these big choices, right?
Yep. And then the few places in the standard library that are maybe subpar, like the ecosystem is definitely more than made up for them. So one, like the most obvious example is HTTP lib2 in the Python standard library is an atrocity on the level of HTTP web requests in .NET. And so there's a library called Requests for Python, which is essentially, I would say it's the Rest Sharp for Python, but like that would be giving Rest Sharp a lot of credit. So Requests for Python is hands down the best HTTP client in any language that I've worked with. And I wrote one, you know, that was relatively popular for .NET. I spend so much time in requests. It's just, it's like such a joy to use. And so it just eliminates the need to deal with the janky one in the standard library, which is most often not the case. The standard library does a really great job.
So I wouldn't say I'm a network guy, but I'm not scared of the network. So the first thing that that popped into my mind when I heard about what the project was and how it worked was, why would I ever use that for internal stuff, say between departments or between floors in a building? You know, if I'm just hitting, you know, someone's internal API, or even an external one, why wouldn't I fire up Wireshark or Fiddler and just, you know, tweak that, replay it? There's Foxy headers. There's some extensions for Chrome.
Charles Proxy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can even set up Squid with script to, you know, capture these requests and replay them back and forth and do whatever you want. So that was kind of my big question. I said I'd emailed support because it said, hey, if you have any questions, email support. And I said, all right.
You're good at following instructions. That's good.
I emailed support and I said, why would I use this over Fiddler or a Wireshark? And they replied back with a very happy answer that I'm sure you're going to cover now.
yeah, for sure. So Fiddler and Charles Proxy, like I use. Mostly I use Charles since I've moved to OS X, but back when I was on Windows, I used Fiddler all the time, and I thought it was a great tool. There's a couple areas where it kind of falls short for like the way that I felt like, or the way that I saw people were doing API development, specifically around public APIs. So one, it's really difficult to put Fiddler on like a staging machine or on your production app or in a mobile app and not have to deal with proxy settings in a way that alters the way your phone behaves or the way your computer behaves or the staging server. So at IFT, I would use Charles Proxy a lot to see local traffic. Then I'd push it to a staging server and suddenly, you know, the request would start failing and I couldn't figure out why. And getting Charles into our EC2 environment on that box that was running that code was impossible, right? So the way our URLs work, you can put them anywhere that your code already exists and you don't have to change the rest of your code. You don't have to set proxy settings. It essentially just works wherever you put it. So it's much easier to get into sort of like nitty gritty areas where you may have access to change the host name, but maybe not proxy settings, or you can't install a desktop app. So I think that's the first thing is to use a buzzword, RunScope is cloud native, right? So like we live in the cloud first, which is where all your code happens to be and all the services you happen to use. So that's why it works really well for those cases. Another thing is that to make Fiddler social, you have to sort of like save a request, email it to somebody, send it to them. They have to load it into Fiddler. They have to have Fiddler. They have to understand Fiddler. Then they can see it and then they can get back to you. So we wanted to really make sort of this social thing part of the core experience that you didn't necessarily have to understand Fiddler to in order to exchange something. So if you send a RunScope share link to, you know, your API provider support team, there's nothing they have to do besides view that in a web browser in order for them to see the request. So that's another place where Fiddler sort of left me wanting more. And then the last one would be, it's not a desktop app. Did I already say that? I do want to look for ways. So I actually have been meaning to do this. I'd really like to write a Fiddler plugin that like interacts with RunScope. So whether it puts requests in from Fiddler or vice versa, I'd really like to like make them interoperable with each other, because Fiddler is one of those great free tools that like are invaluable for a large set of things. And we kind of just want to expand on that and sort of work together to make all of the tooling around this just better as a whole.
Well, and there is an advantage to the desktop app in that it can actually grab a hold of the network card and really inspect all the traffic. And one problem we had recently was that we had some strange proxy issues, our internal proxy. And so if we went off the network, like we went to Starbucks or something, we could make the request with no problem to our this public API we were calling. Mm-hmm. But if we tried to do it internally, there was just no way. And running it through RunScope wouldn't have helped us at that point, because it was our own proxy that was mangling the request going out. And sometimes eventually just started denying it because it was coming in on the wrong port. And we didn't have any way to fix that. So, yeah, you do have to go to like Fiddler, and it would be cool to have Fiddler integrate with RunScope. And I know with the beta 4.0 of Fiddler, there's a pretty easy way to write .NET plugins for it.
Yep.
I think you can even write it in, what does he call it? Fiddler script. I think you can write little scripts too. Was that it?
No. So,
I just had a question. Where'd it go?
You'll remember it while I say this. To reinforce your point, like, we need tools at every layer of this, right? We need them at the network layer. We need them at the application layer. Like, you know, anything that's going over a wire has a lot of moving parts to it. We're really focused on the highest level application layer, but like you mentioned, Wireshark, Fiddler, Charles Proxy can, you know, let you see things at a lower level, and, you know, they're really great for that. And I hope they keep trying to solve those problems even more.
I remember what it was now. At one point, we were having problems with the cert that we had to install to connect to this web API. And it turned out that we had the cert installed, but it wasn't running in the... Even if you read a cert from disk, under Windows at least, it still wants to store the cert in the user's profile. So if you have a service account running the service that's trying to read the cert, it gives you a file not found error, essentially, because there is no user profile associated with the service account. Mm-hmm. And so the solution that QA came up with at one point was, we have to run Fiddler on the server in production for the app to work. And that's when I kind of stepped in and said, if we have to run Fiddler on our production server for the app to work, we've done something horribly wrong.
That would be definitely a code smell.
Okay, I got a question. While we're talking about this integration stuff, you know, I'm thinking, well, okay, if you can integrate with Fiddler, you know, what if you could integrate also with, you know, like maybe Glimpse, and you've got a Glimpse plugin that interfaces with RunScope. But then in order to do that, you need an API as well. Do you have an API yet?
I cannot believe I'm saying this. So after I launched API jobs, I was like inundated with, well, does it have an API? And it had an RSS feed. So I said, yes. I mean, sort of, you know, passing it off, right? Stunningly, nobody has asked me yet if we have our own API. I was so ready to be asked that by 100 people. So it is in development. It should be available soon. It just didn't make the cut for launch, but there are a lot of interesting things, especially around integrations with, you know, like Chrome web dev tools, right? Like, there's a copy as curl command in there right now. I actually would like to just say copy as RunScope URL, or copy export requests out of the Chrome network inspector, or Fiddler, or, I mean, anywhere that there are HTTP requests, I want to, you know, find ways to get them into the system. So the API will be coming soon.
Okay, well, I still want to ask you some other things, but we're kind of short on time. So I'm thinking we transition to lightning round format, and I want to throw a bunch of questions at you that you will hopefully answer as quick as a strike of lightning or similar.
hurting code lightning, or like actual lightning?
Actual lightning.
Okay.
Yeah. No. So you have 2 or 3 seconds between the time you ask the question and then when the lightning actually starts,
that's right. Yes. Okay. You can take slightly longer. Like maybe unionized lightning. Just, you know, like kind of enough not to get fired as lightning, but you know. Okay. So, and some of these are inspired by things I've heard recently on Traffic and Weather, which is your new podcast that you do with Steve Marks, right?
Yes. Trafficandweather.io is the website.
Awesome. And I highly recommend it. I have to say, you know, I used to joke with you that, you know, nobody cares about APIs and APIs are boring.
That was yesterday you said that, right?
No, actually, your podcast really kind of made me start thinking about it in a more interesting way. And, you know, also watching as, you know, more web frameworks move to APIs and, you know, for a lot of different scenarios. But it's not, I thought of it in the past more as kind of like, okay, it's networking stuff you got to do, but it's not that interesting. But on listening to Traffic and Weather, which you can find at trafficandweather.io, you talked about a lot of kind of interesting things. So let me throw one at you. JSON API, what is it and is it good?
So JSON API is at jsonapi.org. It's basically a document spec for standardizing the way you use JSON in an API. So I think it's actually very poorly named because it's too broad. Like I said on the show, it's basically like calling a new programming language like function call or something like that. It's just like it's too broad, but it's really heavily inspired by sort of the documents that the Ember guys were seeing in their apps that they were writing. So the document between the single page Ember app and the backend. I think the spec is good, especially if you're doing that type of thing. If you are doing a public facing API, I don't know that you'll see sort of the benefits that you'll get out of it, but it is largely okay. I wish they would rename it and sort of in a couple places they're like, you can do it this way or this way. I wish they would just pick one because, you know, better specs are more specific. So you should definitely read about it, though. It's at jsonapi.org, I believe.
To me, it sounded like halfway between the JSON spec and XC for JSON. So I kind of said, blah. Well, am I not supposed to be answering these two?
Go ahead.
I never know what I'm doing. Are they having like a sale on .io domain names? Because everyone seems to have a .io now. It's like a few years ago when everyone had the ..
L-Y.
Yeah, L-Y. And then Libya. Then they realized it was Libya. And they were like, wait, Libya? Oh, my God.
So there's no sale on them, but they are available. So it's really tempting. So we actually decided when we were trying to name this company that we had to have the .com. There was no compromising, no using .io.
Okay, back to the lightning. Webhooks. You recently talked about webhooks. Can you, A, describe what are webhooks and then tell me why you're talking about it more recently?
So webhooks are a way for a service to notify you of an event via an HTTP call. So what you say is when something happens on, let's say, for instance, on Stripe, when something happens on Stripe, then make a request to a URL that I control, and then you send event data along with that. So it's basically like a push model for APIs instead of you having to pull the API checking for new data all the time. So I think they started getting popular around 2009. Twilio made really heavy use of them. Pretty much every API provider provides some sort of webhook now for push notifications. There was a recent effort by the Zapier guys, which is an if-like service, around something they called REST hooks, which was like a more structured version of webhooks that also had sort of an idea of like registering them programmatically, which some APIs let you do, but not very many. So in the Zapier/if case, I mean, their proposal would have been great for what we were working on at IFT, but it's basically just a more structured version of webhooks, because right now there's no standard around what the request data should look like when it hits your servers. Every API uses a different schema, whether it's mostly JSON, but some XML or just post parameters. It changes. It's different everywhere. So the REST hooks proposal was sort of an idea to standardize around webhooks. So we use webhooks heavily. So we've actually built that into RunScope. We've put as much effort into that as we have in some of the other API stuff. So we have these capture endpoints that are basically a RunScope URL that don't have a host name, so that when you hit them, it captures the request but doesn't forward it on to something else. And that's really great for when you're debugging webhooks. So you put that capture URL in the webhook provider, generate the hook, and then you can see the request that data that's coming in. When I was doing our Stripe integration, I used that all the time.
Awesome. And I think we've talked about REST hooks on the show going back a ways. One show was, I remember talking with John Udell, and he was a big fan. And then you mentioned it earlier in the show, but I wanted to talk about that a bit. And that is interesting, the whole standardization. And I think you've talked about some different things with managing like REST hooks to request and also manage those callbacks and to aggregate callbacks and things like that. But what I want to ask you now is about stop writing REST API clients. Should I?
So this was a really interesting article because I agreed with the title, which was basically just don't write an SDK anymore. But if I remember the details that I didn't remember, I didn't agree with the reasoning behind it. So there's two arguments you can make here. One is an argument I've been meaning to write down and make for a long time, is that SDKs generally indicate an API smell. They're sort of like covering up for an API that's too complicated, and eventually in the long run become more of a maintenance nightmare than what you get for a short-term benefit for ease of integration. So that would be my argument against using a REST API SDK. If you can at all possible, just stick to finding a good HTTP client and only making requests through there. It just gives you so much more flexibility and so much easier to maintain. The other side of this would be somebody who would argue about client API wrappers from a hypermedia API standpoint, where what they're advocating for is a single unified client, a single uniform interface that basically can understand self-describing APIs and sort of act on them by extracting the operation information and the URLs from the API itself, therefore not needing any upfront knowledge about it. And therefore, since you don't need any upfront knowledge about it, you don't need an SDK written to that specific API. So there's kind of two thoughts there on why you should not be writing REST API clients. In general, if you're an API provider, you probably still want to provide SDKs just because it makes it so much easier to get started, and people getting started quickly is really key to an API provider's business. But if you're the app developer, as soon as you get past that initial, you know, proof of concept phase, I would switch to an HTTP client like requests like Service Stack or like HTTP client on .NET or requests on Python or HTTP party on Ruby or what request I think it is on Node. Basically get down to like making the calls just from an HTTP client, understand the data that's going back and forth, and, you know, funneling as much as possible through RunScope, right?
All right.
Unless you're like a .NET API provider or you're targeting .NET or Java runtimes, because then you really want to write an SDK to hide all of the ugliness and pain associated with making web requests in those languages.
Yep. I mean, plus there's the whole, you know, deserializing data into static classes on Java and .NET. It's one of the few places where actually a really strong SDK probably makes more sense than not having one.
Yeah, especially by the time you pull in, you know, like JSON.NET or whatever, you might as well have, you know, some sort of wrapper. Okay, so one last question here is API security. I notice, you know, you support like OAuth. You talked about that. You make it easy to add authentication to requests. Are we going somewhere with API security? Is this as good as it gets? Is it OAuth 2 from here on out? What's up?
I think it's OAuth 2 for now. It's the best what we got. I mean, it has a lot of problem, and it's a ginormous spec that you can't possibly implement all of. But if you pick the parts that are relative to, you know, related to your application, and you implement it as close to the spec as possible, you're probably good. The most important for any API, though, is that you should never, ever, ever use plain HTTP. You should always use HTTPS. And that's like the biggest, most important thing you can do for any API for securing it. After that, the details are important, but far less important than actually encrypting the messages back and forth. We could do a whole podcast probably just on API security.
All right. Well, I think I had asked my last question. We had one more question. I'll finish with a question from Twitter from Eric Williams, a.k.a. Moto Williams, and he asks you ping pong or foosball, and then he has a hashtag goal.
So I prefer ping pong, but we don't yet have a ping pong table in the office. We do have a TV with FIFA attached to it, so we spend the few moments of recreation time in the office a day generally kicking the virtual soccer ball.
Oh, wait, free sodas?
Yes, we do offer free sodas.
Oh, how about a taco copter?
We don't have a taco copter yet.
Oh, well, okay, sure. And you're not using Node anywhere. Are you sure you're in San Francisco?
You'd be surprised how much more popular Python is here than Node. Node maybe gets all the attention, but Python is where the real business is happening.
All right. On that note, do you have anything speaking anywhere coming up?
So I'll be at API Days. I think it's sf.apidays.io in San Francisco. That's at the end of June. And I will be at API World in October in San Francisco. And I will otherwise come to you. You just email me, john@runscope.com, and I will come to your event.
Or to your house? Like, do you just show up?
If you want to talk APIs, sure. If you want to talk APIs and you've signed up for a team plan, I will come over to your house.
All right. Well, on that note, let's wrap up. Anything you want to throw in there, Scott?
No.
Nope. All right, then. John, anything you want to cover before we wrap?
I'm cutting this. Nope. Awesome. Thanks for having me. Everything is going to be 200 okay.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you very much. And do something else exciting so we can have you back on again soon.
Oh, I will be here anytime. I actually just sit on Skype waiting for you to call me to tell me that herding code is happening.
Wait, do you support the Depot response?
Sure, yeah. We love 418.
Okay. All right, then. Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks, guys.